I'm Steve Lascalzo, and this is The Way. Welcome to This is The Way podcast's reaction and discussion episode for Chapter 21 of The Mandalorian, Season 3, Episode 5, The Pirate. Believe it or not, I've gone back and forth on how much I liked this episode. The parts I liked a lot. I am starting to get wary of the quality of writing. I think, unfortunately, the well-crafted Andor series really does shine a light on the rest of, well, the rest of what Disney's doing on Disney Plus. And by the way, the writing in Obi-Wan Kenobi feels so much worse right now. But I'm also starting to get tired of the tell-don't-show that we're seeing. I wonder how much of this that seems to be going on more frequently in The Mandalorian is to protect against the fact that so much of the focus has been on characters who are not showing their faces. Acting's not just reciting dialogue well, and, you know, I know that's not a revelation to people who have acted. So even when there is a silence in the scene, we can still see acting through the body movements, facial expressions. Yeah, I know, that's still happening here, but we're human. We react to facial expression, and we're not getting that here. I wonder, is so much of this writing issue that we're seeing, I mean, I would call it weaker this season, is it because in some cases we go so long between seeing a face, not just a human face, but even an alien face? Communication is so important. And I know this culture is light on words, heavy on deeds, but it feels like we've lost our way lately. It's not going to get me to stop watching, but I am starting to worry if this is the new way.
We must walk the way together.
March 29th, 2023 is when the episode The Pirate debuted on Disney Plus. We're officially into the second half of the season. The thumbnail description and full episode description are the same. They read, "The people of Navarro need protection from rampant pirate attacks." The runtime for Season 3, Episode 5, Chapter 21 shows up as 44 minutes in parentheses on the Disney Plus show page. If you press play, you get to the credits in 38 minutes of screen time. If you skip the previously on and opening sequences, you can get through the episode in just over 36 minutes until you hit the credits. One of the questions I've started to ask myself is there anything to learn from the concept art during the credits? Well, the Rebel Outpost bartender was a human in the artwork, and I didn't see any signs of Lasat, let alone the most famous one, so that's a little difference. The covert cave meeting fire looked a lot more fierce than the concept art. It looked much more like a bonfire, and there looked to be a lot more Mandalorians there than I can remember. The only other thing I'd bring up is the shot of the derelict Lambda-class shuttle doesn't seem as creepy in the concept art, but it sure does look like Carson Teva is a lot closer in the art than in the show. Don't you hurt the captain.
May the Force be with you, and also with you.
The credits always start with the director, and this week it was Peter Ramsey. His most notable project's probably the Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse animated movie, and while it's well-received, it is animation, so maybe that's why I felt like this episode feels like more like a cartoon than some of the other episodes to me. Now, I'm not saying he did a bad job. I'm not saying he can't hack it in live action.
Are you trying to say something?
Listen, there's a lot of computer animation in Star Wars television now, and knowing how to work with that is a pro, not a con. It does mean story beats are sometimes different, though, because you're animating for economy. So, you know, a lot of the facial expressions and body movements don't get into a scene. Now, I don't think that's not an editing issue or even an issue of animation. I mean, some of the animation out there is really good. But there is that human component to it. You know, they call it the uncanny valley, I think. And I just don't think it's the same. It just doesn't feel the same for me. It still can be good. Bad Batch, you can still enjoy that. Clone Wars, you can still enjoy that. Rebels, you can still enjoy that. It's just not the same. And I spoke of the editing. Well, Jeff Sebanek has done episodes of The Mandalorian Seasons 1, 2, and he edited the season opener, The Apostate. IMDb says he's going to edit the finale of season 3 as well. So this episode is not bad. It's not directed poorly, not edited poorly. I just thought I would love some of this more. Writing credit for the episode goes solely to Jon Favreau this time. I just mentioned some of the difficulties I think he's having with the helmeted cast. And I feel like I have to keep apologizing for not showering this episode with praise. But I still liked it. It just wasn't as good. Two directors of photography this time, neither of them Dean Cundey. First is David Klein, who worked as cinematographer on 5 episodes of The Book of Boba Fett. And by the time this season's done, he'll have 5 of The Mandalorian as well, according to IMDb. Second is Paul Heuwen, and he's got work as a second unit DP for all the episodes of The Book of Boba Fett and Obi-Wan Kenobi. So he gets to step into the big role here, and his resume is full of stuff for Marvel. It goes back a long way, too, so that's nice to see someone that looks like they've earned their opportunity from second unit to full-time. That's all the credit I'm going to be mentioning today for the crew, so let's move on to people playing the characters.
Nobody here gives their real name.
Pedro Pascal is the voice of the Mandalorian, and occasionally he's in the suit, I guess. Most of the time we're seeing either Lateef Crowder or Brendan Wayne, and they continue to get co-starring credits. All that talk about how emoting is important and how it makes dialogue easier when you're doing more well, those are the guys in the suit that make Din Djarin the consistent character that he is for me. Bo-Katan Kryze is played by Katie Sackhoff, and I have to imagine she's happy about being able to show her face again. Carl Weathers is back to acting as Magistrate Greef Karga.
Hi, Magistrate.
Our Twitter follower, Paul Sun-Hyung Lee, gets a lot of screen time in this episode and does some good deeds for the New Republic as Captain Carson Teva. I said it the very first time we saw him on screen. I love the fact that he's a fan who gets to play in this world. He's a frequent responder to us on Twitter, and I know he does follow hundreds of other podcasts, but that works for me. He's sharing his love, and honestly, it pays off in goodwill from his fellow fans. Nothing wrong with that. We continue to be a huge supporter of his. Two things. I want that jacket he's wearing, and I want him to lead the shelved Rangers of the New Republic series.
Captain Carson Teva, Adelphi Rangers!
We find out Katie M. O'Brien has infiltrated requisitions in the New Republic as Elia Kane, and that must be how she had easy access to those yellow travel biscuits, you know, the ones that she used to help trap Dr. Pershing. I also found out from her Twitter, the M is just a way for her credits to be separated more easily from a different Katie O'Brien, and I think that she implied she picked that letter at random. New to the cast is Tim Meadows as
the Colonel.
I've always liked Meadows, but it was a little weird seeing him in Star Wars. I don't know his brand of humor fits in my opinion, although I will say, maybe it's the background impression that made the character of the Colonel seem so ineffective and disinterested. You know, when you think about it, the natural Tim Meadows persona lends itself to that character well. So I looked up famous military titles, and I don't think I could find any matches between any of the early searches that I got, and I don't think there was any clues there. Then I thought, well, okay, maybe they're not going to name this character after a hero named Tuttle, because he's not really heroic. Maybe, you know, it's just a Favreau or Filoni family member, or it could be this. So, you know, you do the searches for Colonel Tuttle or whatever, and then there's an episode of MASH called Tuttle. And I'm getting all this from Wikipedia, so I didn't watch the show or anything. The regular characters of that show were trying to divert funds and supplies to an orphanage in Korea nearby the base. Now, to do that, they created this fictitious officer named Tuttle.
Listen, how did you come up with a name like Tuttle anyway?
He was my imaginary childhood friend.
You had an imaginary friend?
Yeah, if anybody said, who knocked over the garbage? I said, Tuttle. They said, who broke that window? Tuttle.
I didn't watch the episode, but from the description and the connection to some Russian story about a Lieutenant Kij, it seemed like this might be the connection, because it was satire about bureaucracy. And that seems to be exactly what this Colonel Tuttle is representing. So how about that? A possible MASH connection in Star Wars.
Oh, I hated the Colonel with his wee, beady eyes and that smug look on his face.
Emily Swallow is listed next, and I thought we were going to get a name for the armor this week. I think back to the Filoni Ahsoka Lives campaign that clearly mimicked a little of the Frodo Lives movement from the 50s and 60s following the publication of The Return of the King and then paperback versions of that book in the Lord of the Rings series. I know Filoni is a fan of that. I thought perhaps maybe we're going to discover something new about this armorer's identity, but no.
This is the way.
There were two people in Greef Karga's office at the beginning of the episode, but only London Kim gets a credit as the civil engineer. I could not find the woman credited, and I was searching for things like uncredited woman in Karga's office and stuff like that, but you know, I thought maybe a hometown newspaper might have tipped off who it was, but nope. Parvesh Chena is back, voicing the Nevarro copper droid, and I think I decided I just don't like this voice choice. Gorian Shard was voiced by Nanzo Anozi, and the performance was done by Black Chrysanthemum actor Carrie Jones. The Snivian bartender was frequent Star Wars collaborator Misty Rosas, and I called it when I saw her. I knew that it was her. Maybe it was the hair. But she does a lot of that kind of work, and they must like her a lot. Also listed in the cast are Trapper Wolf, Jib Dodger, and Sash Ketter. I thought, when the heck did we see Dave Filoni, Rick Famuyiwa, and Deborah Chow? Well, I had to go back and look. And then when Carson Teva is being presented with the hollow viewer at the bar, the foreground is a little out of focus. You can see, though, the cowboy hat of Trapper and Jib and Sash are on the other side of the frame. But the real gem of the credits and the first thing I looked for was who was the Lasat coming up to Carson Teva in the bar. I thought I heard the voice. And listed as Zeb is Steve Bloom. And yeah, he voiced Gera Zeb Aurelios in Rebels. I think we might get Sabine Wren by the time we're done with the season. I think the announcement of Natasha Liu Bordizzo came early enough. But we still haven't seen Chopper or Hera. But we did see Ahsoka last season and in the Book of Boba Fett. So after all of that, could we possibly see, like, Agent Callus? Fenn Rau? Jacen Syndulla? Or Ezra? Or Thrawn? I think anyone in Rebels is fair game now. I just think anyone that ends up showing up now is probably a setup for the Ahsoka series.
I don't control the wants of others.
Tate Fletcher continues to walk around in the Paz Vizsla armor, and I know Jon Favreau has voiced him, but I wonder if they've also been blending in a little of Tate's voice more and more. I think I still hear Favreau mostly, and maybe it's just him, but I do wonder, maybe they're transitioning for a future episode where he has to take off the helmet? Although, if he does, maybe it will be Favreau, because the action figure of Paz Vizsla, the one with removable helmet, has Favreau's likeness, not Tate Fletcher's.
Achuta, Mando!
Matt Fraser was listed in the episode as Pirate Coxswain. And this time, it was obvious who the character was that he voiced, as opposed to the first episode, The Apostate. I think that means I was right. There had to have been some deleted scene, you know, maybe a line that he gave in the first episode that got cut, because how else would he get credited in that season opener? Misty Rosas is credited with the on-screen performance. And remember, they seem to like her. They give her lots of work. The bartender in this episode, Jawas, stuff like that.
Tika, if you're going to steal my parts and then sell them back to me, could you at least clean them first, as a courtesy?
Vane, the pirate, is again Marty Matulis. I have no problem with the portrayal. In fact, I liked it. But the character getting away again, I don't like that. I think it's a little overdone.
Get out of here, Vane. Now!
Shirley Henderson is credited as the voice of the Anzellan crew, all of them that appeared in the episode. And we've talked before about her connection to Harry Potter and Bridget Jones's Diary.
No, it's crazy! That's crazy! That's crazy! Bad baby. Oh, bad baby.
Sorry about that. He's young. Yeah, bad
baby. Max Lloyd-Jones is back as Carson Teva's new right-hand X-Wing pilot, although we don't see him play Lieutenant Reed like we did in the Book of Boba Fett. We just hear his voice. He was also a stand-in for Luke Skywalker, that is, He was standing in so that the CGI could end up mapping Mark Hamill's face onto an actor during the Chapter 16 episode, The Rescue, where he comes onto the bridge and, you know, wrecks shop. Ian Goodwin is back as a warthog pirate, one of the snub fighter pilots, but it's a different one from the one he played in The Apostate. That one got exploded by Din Djarin. He was wearing a blue vest, and this one in Chapter 21 is just wearing a red vest, so what a way to differentiate these two warthogs. One more note, and it regards a character called Desk Jockey. It's a Rodian. It's basically the secretary outside the colonel's office on Coruscant. She comes in. The performance is done by Dawn Denninger. She must love putting on Rodian makeup. I mean, I don't think this is a coincidence that she's played a Rodian so often in the Book of Boba Fett and this series. I think this is the same Rodian mom of the girl that Din Djarin meets on the transport to Tatooine. It's the same one that took her little girl to Monument Plaza to see the magician in episode 3. I am calling it.
Okay, then.
The previously on segment starts with the Darksaber and the dialogue from the Book of Boba Fett where Din Djarin is explaining to Paz Vizsla that he defeated Moff Gideon and therefore I'm the rightful owner of the blade. Instead of death, Moff Gideon is supposed to face a new Republic tribunal, but death would have been justice, according to Vizsla in that scene, and I don't think any of us expect him to ever actually face real justice. We see a bit of Bo-Katan's heroics in the last episode before the Armorer congratulates her on performing the highest honor of the creed. That is, saving a foundling.
I believe the children are our future. Thank you. Teach them well and let them lead the way.
Then we see Nevarro and Greef Karga extolling the virtues and making a pitch to Din Djarin about
huge tracts of land
and how it can be all yours if you sign up to be my lawman.
I better rehearse my speech.
The last thing Karga wants, he says, is to bow down to another far-off bureaucracy. Well, good luck with that. Then there's a scene of the pirates reminding us this school used to be a bar. Then Karga and Djarin blast the bad guys who are trying to outdraw our heroes, but they leave Vane alive. He later tries to ambush Mando and Grogu in space with some of his pirate pilots, but he fails. He's chased back to Pirate King Gorian Shard's ship. Daddy Din teaches Grogu, never trust a pirate, and they jet off, setting up this episode's story. That action happened in Chapter 17. And now we're in Chapter 21, so a lot's happened in between those moments. But after the Lucasfilm Limited and Star Wars sequence appear, a ship lands on Nevarro, I think, carrying some of those pirates. Karga is in his office talking about expanding Nevarro for trade, even putting in a rail line, but, I mean, that has to come first in town planning, doesn't it? I mean, I guess in Star Wars, property ownership doesn't really matter as much. Karga's meeting is interrupted when Gorian Shard's ship enters the atmosphere and hovers over the city. Karga has a hollow audience with Shard right there in his office. I thought it was a nice touch for Carl Weathers to show us, you know, Karga was attempting to seem more intimidating, and he tries to make himself a bigger presence through his stature. And this felt like some good Star Wars dialogue to me.
Don't mistake my hospitality for weakness.
Is that what you call gunning down my helmsman in cold blood? When he let down his guard on your planet?
He shot first.
Well, now I will shoot first.
He shot first. A little on the nose, I guess, but to me it worked. It's a nice line for those who notice the connection to the Han vs. Greedo debate, but it doesn't feel forced. Karga pretends he has connections to the New Republic, mentioning something called the Spinward patrols, and I'm thinking that means the spinning arms of the galaxy or something. I don't know. Shard says, I can read the charts. There's no signed charter, and furthermore, Karga's operations aren't protected anymore by Moff Gideon either. This is our first hint, I guess, at tactics of the First Order. You know, you harass anyone with a New Republic, we'll let you, until they sign up with us. I think that's what we're supposed to guess is the case.
The New Republic can't even protect the Midrim from the Pirate Nation.
That's a damning accusation. If it's true, that shows how ineffectual this new government is, and it probably shows us just how corrupt. I'm not saying the First Order has formed yet, but I don't think that the Empire has gone away. The Outer Rim has been portrayed as like the Wild West since the beginning. I mean, Tatooine is in the Outer Rim. Well, if core systems like Coruscant are corrupt as we believe, and the Mid-Rim is under constant threat, what hope does somewhere like Navarro have?
This isn't Sabacc. You can't bluff your way out of this one, Gaga. Hail me again, unless it's to surrender.
Sabacc, a card game Han and Lando have played for the Falcon, or the ownership of it. The line about bluffing shows Shard is on to Karga's charade, but as he mentioned earlier, he's gonna shoot first. Karga doesn't take too long to think about it. He calls over an astromech and leans over. This is him about to record a message like we saw in A New Hope. And like Leia, he's not going to be taking an escape pod out either. He tells his droids to send out the word, evacuate everyone to the lava flats. It doesn't seem like a safe place, but I suppose anywhere is safer than the town right now. Who's this message going to go to? His buddy Cara Dune? The former marshal? Nope. The title slate appears. The Pirate is the title. Not much to discern from that. I mean, not all of them need to have some deeper meaning, right? A Y-Wing is on approach to a seaside base. Apparently, this is a Delphi base. It's the one that Teva and Wolf asked Din Djarin to accompany them to back in Chapter 10. That was when he was, you know, he tried to evade them, went down to the ice planet, fought off the spiders on that Maldo Crease planet, and then they let him go. I got a sense that this base was like kind of in Vietnam. It was like a chopper coming in on an episode of China Beach or maybe even Forrest Gump. It's not Carson Teva in the ship, though. He flies an X-Wing, but more on that. He's at the bar already, so is this like the mail coming? I think it's actually our old Lasat friend coming in for a landing, but I don't know. Most of the pilots that are already there in the bar are drinking spatchka, I think, or some form of it. I think we see a shot where Teva's closest glass is actually containing spatchka too. But maybe there are different flavors and different colors of it too. I don't know. So maybe this is the Y-Wing being a mail carrier, and maybe Garza Aurelio's coming in delivering part of the mail. I don't know how it happened, but maybe it makes sense because the Snivian bartender comes to Teva, has this data card, and, you know, she gives it to him.
Message for you, son.
But he doesn't have a holo reader, so he asks to use the phone behind the bar, basically. And in the shot's foreground, we end up seeing the familiar pilots, Trapper Wolf in the cowboy hat, Sash Ketter, Jib Dodger. I mean, Dave Filoni, Deborah Chow, Rick Famuyiwa, they're hanging out on set for director Peter Ramsey. It was a nice touch to have him there. The recording is Karga asking for help.
Captain Taylor, we have been attacked by Pirate King Gorian Shard. You once offered that I might reach out to you. I am humbly requesting the New Republic to send a patrol to clear out the raiders. I don't ask for your aid lightly. The situation is dire. I'm afraid that our planet will fall and Shard will turn this into a pirate base.
We see Paul Sun Hyung Lee reacting in the foreground, and then in the background of that close-up, we see a New Republic pilot turn around. We think, hey, he's going to say something, but it's not him. It's a Lasat lumbering into the shot, dressed in blue, that talks with Teva.
Too bad. I really thought Navarro was going to make it.
And for this to Coruscant. Request permission to intercede.
They haven't returned a dispatch in weeks. They're swamped. They'll never get an answer in time.
Then I'm just going to have to go there and talk to them myself. They can't ignore me face to face.
I like your attitude. Good luck. You're going to need it.
Confirmed, it is Zeb. He delivers the Han Solo, good luck, you're going to need it line, too. I mean, it didn't feel forced to me. This is the kind of cameo that I want. I mean, I don't even know if it's quite a cameo, but I'm pretty sure he's going to show up in Ahsoka. It didn't feel forced here. And everything fits. The pilot bar, much cooler than any cantina to me. gave off some VFW vibes, and they weren't above having a few trophy helmets, even part of an Imperial probe droid on display. Teva decides to visit Coruscant from there, making this the second time this season we've visited the former Republic and Imperial capital. But he's got to do it alone.
Captain Teva here to see Colonel Tuttle.
I was wondering if the building he is going into might have been a former ISB office building or something like that, but I couldn't find a matching shot in Andor or any of the other shots from the series. Teva is there, though, to see a Tuttle in requisitions. This is where I think the Easter egg for MASH comes in. Tuttle being a character in that show to divert funds from a bureaucracy to an orphanage in need. Here, Teva's going to a requisitions officer to get authorization to help a non-chartered planet. Tuttle's in the middle of receiving discs to check, just like we had seen Pershing doing. But wouldn't it be interesting if this same droid was delivering new work because he had to pick up Pershing's slack? I tried checking this scene against the one in episode 3, but we only see the back of the tray in chapter 19, not the front, so maybe?
It's okay, he can stay. You, Scoot.
The Rodian desk jockey that comes in is played by Don Dinninger, and my theory is that this is the same Rodian that's the mom to the little girl that was on a transport ship to Tatooine with Din Djarin in the Book of Boba Fett. I'm basing that not just off Don Dinninger's performance of both Rodians, but the little girl on the ship was played by the same little girl that played the Rodian girl in Monument Plaza earlier this season as well. Not a big deal either way. It's just what I think is a fun connection. I think the little girl on the ship and the little girl at Monument Plaza, they both had moms. And now this Rodian, also played by Don Dinninger, is playing her in this office. I think it fits. Teva introduces himself, so we know there's not a personal connection between him and Tuttle. But there is one between Tuttle and someone in his office who's been there a little while. Elia Kane was in the outer office when Teva arrived. She sees this pilot come in. She's a nosy comms officer. She hangs out in earshot of the conversation. Teva gives over the message. Tuttle starts listening to it, but doesn't even finish it. He shows just the slightest bit of interest in the development. And that is when Kane makes her move.
I get the gist. It does sound concerning.
Excuse me. Colonel, I'm going down to the commissary. Can I get you anything?
Thank you, and I'm fine for now. I'm sorry, officer, you spent some time in the Outer Rim, right? Have you ever heard of Navarro?
I have. Spent some time there, in fact. They have yet to sign the charter. They're not a member planet.
Uh-oh. It's not good.
I've had my issues with the writing. I've let them be known, but here I thought it was brilliant. Very efficient. She distracts because she's been cozying up to Tuttle, and we can only assume for quite some time, you know, she knows how and when to insert herself. He does ask for her opinion, knowing already she spent time in the Outer Rim. And then she's able to now not only drop in some doubt into the conversation, she tells us straight out, I spent time on Navarro. Tuttle knows that was for the Empire, so what should disqualify her from this conversation actually ends up being a crucial part of Tuttle's decision. Also, there's a shot of Kane's amnesty badge. It's an Oribesh A, maybe for amnesty, and the background's red. Is this amnesty badge like the Scarlet Letter?
We can't leave them defenseless.
Of course not. But we have a backlog of requests from member worlds that have priority. I don't even know if we have the resources, especially for pirates.
I don't think that this is an isolated episode. Navarro has reported accounts of stormtroopers in the streets and TIE fighters openly flying above. The citizens speak of Moff Gideon occupying the town, and now a pirate king is attempting the same thing? These events could all be connected.
I think that's a bit of a leap.
Really? Because I'm hearing Moff Gideon never made it to trial.
So for a second time, we're hearing there is a rumor about Moff Gideon. And honestly, by now, if you're surprised that he didn't get to trial, I just don't know what show you're watching. Because they're making sure that we remember this. Oh, and Tuttle doesn't know if they have the resources? He's a requisitions officer. What better way to tell us you're bad at your job?
Captain, this isn't a rebellion anymore. We have a structure now. I work in requisitions, so let's focus on what you require.
I thought the dialogue was great. I thought the acting was great. And, I mean, it's showing us, yeah, the New Republic sure isn't operating efficiently. I mean, I don't know that the Empire would have done better, or the Republic, or the Old Republic, but if only there was this group of peace-loving guardians that used laser swords and could control things with their minds. Oops.
Perhaps the leaders of Navarro need to understand why becoming a Republic signatory is valuable.
By letting them suffer. Sounds like a rather imperial way of thinking.
Captain, you're out of line.
It's fine. I'm used to that kind of talk. But from experience, it often takes a new perspective before one is able to see the light.
You and your sword didn't see the light. You were captured.
No. I was liberated.
Whoa there, Elia. Forget why you're there? I mean, lay off the space Atsine talk. Teva ends up getting a non-committal promise to try and allocate some resources, but that's bureaucrat for we're not doing anything. Then we get sent off with a reminder.
There's something dangerous happening out there. All these events, it's not coincidence. And by the time it becomes big enough for you to act, it'll be too late.
From Coruscant, we check back in on Navarro for a brief moment with the camp of survivors. Magistrate Karga.
High Magistrate.
Is trying to do the noble thing here and keep them all calm by lying to them. Now, we know help is coming, but he acts as if it's this foregone conclusion. It's only by a bit of, well, some miraculous set of circumstances that help actually comes. First, okay, Teva had to know where to fly. If it wasn't for a certain purchase by Din Djarin early in the season, there wouldn't have been any chance. You see, Teva is next seen flying to the Mandalorian covert. How? I mean, he tracks some signal and happens to spot a Komark-class fighter transport, Bo-Katan ship, the Gauntlet, parked there on the surface. Everyone's wondering, how did he get here?
Captain Carson Teva! Adelphi Rangers! I have a time-pressing matter to attend to.
Clear out, Blue Boy. The New Republic isn't welcome here.
How did you manage to find us? Mandalorians pride ourselves on our secrecy.
He's smart enough to announce his presence, but I don't get the Blue Boy comment. He's wearing orange, and I know police are called blue, but he's not exactly police. But this must be something from Legends that I'm not aware of.
Fortunately, someone I served with in the Rebellion is amongst your ranks. Thanks, R5.
What a rat. R5 ratted out the Mandalorians and his new owner? I mean, I like the moment of confusion, though. Everyone looking around, who is this plant? or who is this person that's on the inside?
The entire covert will now have to relocate.
Or we could kill him. Stay right here.
This man cut me a break once, and now I'm returning the favor. Clear out, Blue.
Grief Karga sent this holo message.
Again, love the nod to the Mandalorians, not knowing if he was pulling a piece from his jacket. It's just the message. But the connection that we've seen built up since Season 2 is paying off. Yeah, it's not by the book. I mean, these guys are giving each other breaks here. That's why following orders blindly gets communities into trouble. When a good lawman like Teva bends, the peace ends up being kept. When a corrupt one bends, especially to the wrong people, situations get worse. When no one bends, nobody wins. That might be the most fair, but it doesn't foster goodwill in the galaxy, and it doesn't get people to sign the charter, I suppose. I really did like this scene with Din and Carson.
Something doesn't smell right. Look, it's not your fight. I just came to tell you your friend is in danger, and I thought you should know.
Great line, but also it's the kind of line that's true, and the kind of line that works in this situation.
I know you'll relocate anyway, but you have my word. I will not reveal your location. Sorry to intrude.
I've done a lot of talking so far and played a lot of clips so far. There's a lot of stuff packed into this episode already. Most of what's coming is action capped off by another group of scenes setting up the last three episodes, but we're not done on the planet yet.
So what are you thinking?
He's right. I gotta help the guy.
You can't do it alone.
There's the campfire scene where he who holds the hammer may speak. I like that touch for this culture centered around their forged armor and how important that is. Mando makes his case as to why they should help, and he presents the promise from Karga that he doesn't really have authority to grant to the rest of them, but, you know, Karga is in a take-it-or-leave-it situation anyway. I mean, they're going to get that land. The armorer asks if anyone else needs to speak, and the way it starts off with Paz Vizsla, we're meant to think there's a possibility that he's going to deny Din Djarin and his friend aid. I saw right through that, though. I mean, I don't know who wouldn't. He played his previous disagreements into the very reason to help. His son was saved by Din and Bo-Katan without hesitance. Helping your fellow Mandalorian isn't a request, it's the way.
The question we should be asking ourselves is why? Why should we lay our lives down yet again? Because we are Mandalorians! I have had my disagreements with this man, but he risked his life to save my son. And Bo-Katan Kryze did not give up on my child's life. These two are asking us to take up arms in the name of a brighter future. And I, for one, will take up arms to fight by their side. This is the way.
This is the way.
This is the way.
Then we get a bunch of scenes setting up the assault, and I didn't pay much attention to the scene on first watch, but I really liked how Bo-Katan briefed both the fighters on the transport and Din Djarin in hyperspace at the same time. And I liked how she wasn't just the girl who, you know, lets you borrow her truck to move or something. She planned things. She had good intel. And now, I mean, how did she get that intel? I'm not really going to let that concern me. I think it's fair to nitpick. But, you know, she did hear from Din Djarin, so maybe he told her a little bit about what they're up against. And her tactics seemed sound, but also I noticed this line.
Nevarro is an independent planet, and no longer under Remnant Imperial or New Republic protection. But it's that very independence that makes it appealing for you to settle.
You can settle? She's not feeling like part of the group. Or maybe she just intends to go back and rebuild her home, but then why not offer her home to rebuild? Isn't that just as safe as this place? I mean, sure, yeah, it got bombed and it's her home, but they've not really got a lot of resources on Nevarro. Either place offers the same limited safety.
You lived there once, hiding in the sewers. But now, you can be heroes.
We see the streets of Nevarro have been hit hard by Shard's ship. The pirates are looting and having their fun. But why aren't they just looting and leaving? Why are they still hanging out? In the first episode of the season, we heard Din say, Gorin Shard should stick to hijacking and ransoming. This isn't even his gig. We've heard no ransom demand. It doesn't seem like the pirates were going to hit this place and stick around, but maybe they're waiting for some retaliation. Maybe that's the whole purpose. And when the N1 starts the attack on Shard's ship, Shard first orders gunners to the gunwales, and then he launches the snub fighters.
Follow him!
Bold of you to return,
Mandalorian! Blast that ship!
Vane is back leading these pilots, I guess since he's still around, right? And everyone else is still just calling this guy Mandalorian, but I think that's just for us. The dogfighting is cool, but I was under the impression that at least 5 of the 6 ships that launched against Din and the Apostate ended up being destroyed. It's nice that he's got some backups already in play, right? And he's got pilots to fly them.
Thanks for your help, Mando.
I decided to take you up on your offer for a tract of land.
Be careful, my friend. They've got you outnumbered 10-1.
I like those odds.
I bet you do.
I mean, I'm a sucker for callback lines, and anytime you mention the odds in Star Wars, I'm good. The distraction in the air works great. This is when we get the drop of the Mandalorians from the trailers.
The Corsair's on me. Coast is clear.
Approaching drop point. First team, prepare to drop. First team away.
And with that, I think we're officially done with shots from the trailer. Nothing's left. I mean, we're flying blind here. Anything and everything's on the table. I love the battling in the streets. I love that it wasn't a cakewalk, but they still got to show off all their skills. Now, if it had been too easy, we'd have wondered, you know, why weren't they just scouting out worlds where they could go in, clean up, and stake some sort of claim? I like the Anzellans cheering them on. I like the Kowakian monkey lizards ratting out the pirates.
Possible ambush. Take cover.
Bo-Katan helping Din out with air support. That was great. The ship battles are really important to me. I mean, they have to look good. And they did. I especially liked how quick the N1 seemed against the Snub Fighters.
He's above you! He's below you!
Another engine down, and shields are failing!
I mean, if you are going to have Vane stick around, I mean, I guess you can have him deliver that line, right? And then we get that dank Ferrick from Gorian Shard. Then Space Smee informs Gorian Hook, the engines are down and shields are failing. The Mandos on the ground are facing the appropriate amount of adversity, in my opinion. But it was the armorer walking into Karga's office that puts a smile on my face every time. She walks in and just owns the joint with the hammer and tongs. She's a melee master. The thing I didn't like was when the pirates ended up running out of town. I mean, they had no small travel craft available, and they're just running out like that. Plus, they run into the townspeople who now they're not afraid? Even against desperate pirates who have better weapons?
There's only one Snub Fighter left, Captain.
It's been a pleasure serving you, Captain.
But it's time to part ways.
Vane, you coward!
Sir, we're down to our last engine! We have to retreat!
In a puff of pig's eye!
Open fire below!
Vane waits until now to escape, and he announces it. I felt like he gets away too easy, and I also don't like that this is probably going to be how Moff Gideon ends up finding out the pirates failed. That's just me. I'm not saying bad writing, bad plot. I just didn't like Vane getting away twice. I would have rather had Space Me take an escape ship as the Cumulus craft was going down or something. On that, no air support, Shard decides to open fire on the people, and he gets closer and closer to the gathering on the edge of town with his blast before the Gauntlet and Din's N1 finish off the shields, and the ship ends up crashing into the mountainside. I thought it was going to trigger an eruption, but no, it doesn't. The sound engineers did use the same kind of crash sound we heard in Return of the Jedi when the Star Destroyer crashed into the surface of the second Death Star. Yay, the threat is over! No Yub-Nub, but the Anzellans cheering, "It's gonna be okay!" was funny. Karga thanks the heroes of Navarro and then cedes them land.
From this day forward, I, Magistrate Greef Karga, High Magistrate Greef Karga, hereby cede all land from the Western Lava Flats to Bullock Canyon to the fine people of Mandalore. You may no longer have a home planet, but you do now have a home. Welcome.
Good to see he made good on his promise to Din Djarin, and I don't know that he's got really any other option, but I was one of the first to post about this connection. You know, from the Lava Flats to Bullock Canyon, that's a connection to Jeremy Bullock, the first person to put on the armor way back in the original trilogy as Boba Fett. Listen, I'm not saying I was the only one to notice, but it did get me wondering who was seeing my post and then passing it off to YouTubers who are using it. Now, if I'm not going to earn credit for spotting or being the first to mention it, I just won't do it anymore. And again, I'm not saying I'm the only one who made that connection. But early in the day, people were asking, hey, you have any, you know, hints? And I didn't see anybody posting it. I posted it early. And then all of a sudden, by the end of the day, everybody's saying, oh yeah, that's Jeremy Bullitt.
The Armorer wishes to speak with you.
So Paz speaks to Bo-Katan and tells her the Armorer wants an audience. She doesn't have a name. It's just the Armorer to them too. That's okay. I just thought maybe we would get a little bit more background. Bo-Katan is led into the covert hiding spot we first saw in Season 1. The Forge has been abandoned. The Armorer talks about it like being representative of a Great One on Mandalore. And for me, I got this Lord of the Rings vibe. You know, the great dwarven forges of Khazad-dûm and the Lonely Mountain. Since Bo-Katan told her of the Mythosaur, I think that information has been bouncing around in the back of her mind. She even ends up telling Bo-Katan, take off your helmet. I wonder, why not do this above ground? And why not have this conversation around others? Why not, though? If you're going to do it first and make sure, then why not say, hey, put the helmet back on, then we're going to walk out, and then I'm going to have the same kind of conversation, and then you remove it in front of the others above. I mean, I really felt like we were about to see Emily Swallow's face down here. I thought she's going to take her helmet off too, and we're going to find out who this is.
Our people have strayed from the way, and it is not enough for a few to walk it. We must walk it together.
This is the way.
We must walk the way together. All Mandalorians.
I understand.
I just was wondering, like, what's going on here? What is the importance of this? But Bo-Katan says she understands, but how could she? She has so often failed to rally her people.
I was taught that the Mythosaur existed only in legends. And yet, you saw it. It is a sign that the next age is upon us. Mandalore must all come together. You have walked both worlds. You are the one who can unite us.
So finally we hear, okay, it is because she saw the Mythosaur and there's these legends, but if the shot had lingered on Bo-Katan anymore, I wonder if tears wouldn't have been forming on her face. I mean, this is someone else telling her, you should be the leader. It's what she's been after. I mean, she wants to lead. She feels it's her density. I mean, her destiny. The scene shifts back to the people outside town, but the armor is now walking side by side with a helmetless Bo-Katan. The other Mandalorians don't seem to be on board with this.
But she shows her face.
Bo-Katan walks both worlds. And she can bring all tribes together.
Again, why not just have her put the helmet back on and then have the armor in front of everybody say, okay, and now you may take off your helmet for this reason and this reason. Well, when the armor says, you know, all of that, we get the shot of Bo-Katan's face, the hero pose.
It is time to retake Mandalore.
Then she continues, and we get another hero pose just a few minutes later, this time a push into a close-up. So, credit time and concept art, right? No. Space. Carson Teva on patrol in his X-Wing. I thought he was done for. I mean, when he showed up, all alone, the super creepy scene, he comes upon the derelict Lambda shuttle with a breached hull, contacts his old buddy Lieutenant Reed, and I thought, you know, we were going to find out, oh, Reed's been right behind him, and now he blasts him. I was so paranoid. But Teva has his astromech, R7, launch a probe, scans the inside of the ship.
It's a New Republic prison transport.
Check the departure times.
I'll be damned. Flight times match the ship transporting Moff Gideon.
I knew it. He never made it to trial.
He says there don't appear to be any survivors. Moff Gideon isn't among them. It seems like this was an extraction. Embedded in the walls, conveniently, however, A crucial piece of information, but it's one that could pit the New Republic against an entire culture of people. Maybe, just maybe, it was planted there. Or, if it's not, maybe it's a faction of the Mandalorians that are loyal to Moff Gideon. And all this tension that might erupt, well, that is if the New Republic suddenly starts to care about what's going on out there.
There appears to be something embedded in the cabin wall. Getting close on that. It's a fragment of Beskar alloy.
Are you saying that Moff Gideon was taken by Mandalorians?
All right, what do you think? With only 3 episodes left, there's a lot to cover, unless this entire season just ends up being a setup for a 4th. But wouldn't that be a letdown? I mean, I'm not saying every season needs to be self-contained, but if you're doing this, just make the season 16 episodes long. This new trend, I mean, it's not new to The Mandalorian, they've been doing it since the beginning, but this trend of short seasons, 8-6 episodes, stuff like that, it really bugs the heck out of me. I mean, I long for the days of 20-something episodes where I could talk about, oh, all these episodes are filler, or, I these one-offs. I wish we had that. You want to tell a story and you can't fit it? Just make the season longer. Tell your story. Maybe tell those one-offs in between. Give us more, and you won't have to make every show effects heavy. If you're giving us 8 episodes, we're going to expect more. I'm worried we're not going to get a satisfying wrap-up and just have to wait 2 more years for more episodes to finish a story they just started telling us in episode 5 of this season. But you let me know what you think. You can interact with us in one of several ways. To find out how, visit our Linktree site at linktr.ee/thisistheway pod. Email goes to thisistheway podcast@gmail.com. Twitter and Instagram handles are both @thisistheway pod and on Facebook, just like Linktree. /thisistheway pod. Search for us now on YouTube as well, and please subscribe. Thank you for joining me for This Is The Way Podcast's 122nd episode, our reaction and discussion of The Pirate, Season 3, Episode 5, Chapter 21 of The Mandalorian. I'm your host, Steve Lascalzo, and this is The Way. May the Force be with you always.